I think the Sade being the lead and the face and the visualization of that group is what changes it. Because as much as Sweetback kept their sound intact, I think they're looked at as a group, Sweetback, as these are some dope-ass white boys. Sade is looked at as a black group.
Yeah. It's funny, isn't it?
Same music.
It's a black group.
But what she adds changes it. It's almost like the black drop theory we have about human beings. Like one yes. black drop get it, it all turns black. And that's all it takes for Sade. That's it, you black now.
Welcome to the B-side. The Music Snobs.
This is the Music Snobs Podcast. My name is Arthur, your lead voice, and I am joined by my co-hosts, Scoop, Donnie, and Jahan. I watched a good portion of the Grammys. I probably watched the last two-thirds of the Grammys. And I saw Silk Sonic, Bruno Mars, Anderson .Paak. I saw Silk Sonic win, I think they won Song of the Year for Leave the Door Open. And I probably should have just Wikipedia'd the last 10 years. But I was thinking about, okay, well, wow. I mean, Song of the Year, it's an R&B song. But from a categorization standpoint, it's something other than R&B. Well, maybe it's pop.
Bruno Mars, in their minds, is not R&B. He's a pop artist.
Mm.
Yeah, so, yeah.
But there's so much in that song itself. You know, I mean, Anderson .Paak, just by his damn self, I mean, he's like little Bobby Womack to
right.
me. And on several occasions on this show, I mean, I say it jokingly, but I'm dead serious. You know, Bruno Mars is black enough for me.
But,
I like Bruno.
But for them, he's white enough.
A lot of the music that you listen to, I listen to, we listen to, is, particularly at the popular music level, is an amalgamation of so many styles, many of which originated by black musicians, black artists.
Yeah.
And it just gets rolled over and rolled over and rolled over, and it turns into a lot of what we got now. So, the Music Snobs presents... a brief history of black music by white artists.
Keep on bringing a brief.
So look, the way that we want to do this, it's not such so tightly structured so much as that we do want to maintain, you know, some kind of a scope. So we have a bulleted list, I think about 10 artists, through multiple genres, and like maybe, you know, the last 50, 60 years of what we know as popular music. So I'll just rattle off a name.
And what are we going to do when you give us a name of an artist? What are we doing? What are we evaluating?
Well, based on our opinions of the artist, I say evaluate whether they are contributing to the music that's influenced them, or they're really culture vultures. An artist quote. And with that, let's get started. And I want to start with one of my favorite rock groups ever, Led Zeppelin. Zeppelin is founded in the late 1960s, and they're part of a larger group of bands that came into their own at the tail end of what's called the British Invasion. Now, most of these bands of this ilk, Led Zeppelin, Cream, Black Sabbath, Deep Purple, Rolling Stones, were core blues bands. They literally worshipped at the feet of Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf. I actually go through my own issues of whether or not Led Zeppelin co-opted the black musical structure for their own success. And the reason why is that there are certain songs that they have in their catalog. Mm-hmm. Chief among those is Black Dog, which is one of their most famous songs. Kicks off the Led Zeppelin IV album from 1971. And other songs, Black Country Woman, There's another one that saw Physical Graffiti. Whenever Robert Plant, the lead vocalist, whenever Robert Plant starts to sing a song that is discussing directly or indirectly black women, he changes the style of his voice. Almost as if to get into blackface, to be honest with you. Almost to get into what he perceives as a character, how this needs to be sung, you know. And it'll be, hey, hey, mama. Trigger is always like, if he's talking about mama, he's singing in this style. That's very different. And for the audience to get an idea of what I'm talking about, listen to Black Dog, track number one, Led Zeppelin 4. Listen to how Robert Plant is singing it. And then listen to Misty Mountain Hop, same album. Same guy, same rock and roll, same kind of funky song, but there is some nuance there that makes me kind of cringe. As much as I like Black Dog, as much as I enjoy playing Black Dog on my drums, it always kind of gives me a cringe. Am I the only one that knows what this song is on the
no.
song? Because I'm kind of like the in-house rock guy. I know that.
Yeah. No. I know the song. And I'm not as acutely aware of the distinction in sound and placing it the way you placed it. You know, but my problem has been that because I love Led Zeppelin so much and I think they've executed not necessarily a black sound or a blues sound. They're like a white blues band. Like, they perfected what they were doing so well, it almost like drowns out anything that could go wrong. You know, I've always felt that in my book, they've always been the pound for pound best, greatest white group ever, in my book. So, it's hard for me to find flaws or find that distinction whereas I'm hearing something directed towards a singular group by what Robert is doing. I'm like, oh, he just decided to change the structure of his voice the same way Kendrick Lamar does it from song to song to song. You know, I never looked at it. I always look at it as artistic as nothing else. So,
yeah.
And maybe it's because in my mind they do what they do so well. It's hard for me to look, you know, past or into that as acutely as you have. So it's not that I don't know exactly what you're talking about. I know the song. I just have never looked at it that way. Now I'm going to have to go back and listen to it and see if it's, in my mind, worthy of... All right, maybe there is something there from my standpoint. Because if you say it, there must be something there.
I think the challenge for me with Led Zeppelin is undeniably a great band. Arthur, like you said, chiefly a blues band. The conundrum to me is, despite how good they are, and despite how genuine they are, they have taken like wholesale songs from other artists, black and white. There's even a Wikipedia page about it. Willie Dixon, Howling Wolf, there's like so many signature, I'm talking about signature songs. I Can't Quit You, Baby.
Whole Lot of Love.
Signature Zeppelin tunes, which are effectively written, at least in large musical part, by other artists. That to me is a conundrum. You can be as good as you can be. And I think certainly Robert Plant, one of the great vocalists of our time, Jimmy Page, certainly one of the great guitarists of our time, of any race. But as good as you are, if you've taken like wholesale music from other people and you're passing it off as your own, I think it gets difficult. It gets difficult to give you all your props.
Right, right. It's the depth.
You know, in the late 80s, early 90s, hip hop got into a lot of trouble over sampling and the lack of providing credit or royalties to the original artist. De La Soul was the one that really got
the volume
dragged
samples,
through the courts behind that, right? So to me, this is almost like, and I'm not denying anything that you're saying. I mean, I totally agree with you. And I'm not even necessarily trying to be objective, but putting it into a context of, here's England that I would imagine in the post-World War II 40s and 50s did not have a large black population.
Absolutely.
This music, blues, did not exist in the UK. So these artists, quote unquote, sampled, and we're charging, well, you know, y'all got robbed because, you know, y'all robbing people because you're not giving to any credit to the music that you are lifting this from. It's that same kind of argument, right? It's that same kind of...
I mean, every musician alive, black, white, whatever, every musician alive learns from, is inspired by, borrows from a style. What I'm talking about is when you actually take wholesale sections, when you take wholesale ideas and you don't credit. So it's what Arthur, I guess, is saying about effectively the equivalent of sampling.
Yeah, from just the concept of it, the construct.
I have issues with that argument, though, because we never discredited De La for borrowing that stuff from the Turtles. We just said it sounded good. So as long as it's done well, what does giving credit really
do? Well, it gets you paid. Like, why? It gets the originator paid, firstly.
Just for the music, though. You see what I'm saying? Because you brought up Led Zeppelin taking the songs and stuff, but we all agree that they stole it and did it well. Are you adding on to there the fact that they didn't give credit as a... And I get we diminished that, but the music is still great. We're not diminishing...
Undeniably.
Okay. I'm just going to try and be clear on that one.
If you're taking the song, no matter how well you're performing it, if you didn't necessarily write it yourself... Or if you're not giving credit to the people,
what is credit, though? I don't know what is credit. Like, what is giving? Like, because I think there's some people on this list. When we get down to it, they may not have known.
Yeah. Well, you know what? Then I'll draw my line under it by saying, as much as I love Zeppelin, there's always a little bit of a question mark to me over their contribution beyond just performance of it.
There's something that needs to be spoken, because I think it bleeds. It bleeds over into a bigger situation. And to answer Jahan's question, there's credit, that's one thing, but I think of it as acknowledgement. Like, just acknowledge that we exist. And the problem that you're having, I think we all have, and this is where the racial dynamic, I think, comes into it, is because when you're looking at black creativity, we have had so much of our creativity stolen and taken without being acknowledged.
Exactly.
And that's attached to, especially here in America, of us being stolen and taken as people. So what happens is that when you don't acknowledge us, it becomes a problem, because it's attached to something much bigger than just music. It's like you all are now continuing, from a music standpoint, what you did to us as human beings. You are taking us and not acknowledging our existence or our role. So that's
and assuming the role of creator.
Right, and just assuming the role of creator. So it's just like, it's not giving credit, just acknowledge that we played a role. And that's where the bigger problem comes in, with us in accepting that. You know, if you want to get credit, fine, but it's the acknowledgement or lack of acknowledgement that's attached to our history as black people in this country when it comes to white people, and when they start co-opting us as human beings and our creativity. That's the bigger picture. And that's why it's hard for those of us who even love Led Zeppelin to be like, you know, we love what you all are doing, and I'm with Donnie. You all are doing it better, and you all are doing it great, but it's hard to overlook it when you're not even acknowledging us at all, because that non-acknowledgement is not a standalone with us. That non-acknowledgement is our history, and now it's playing itself in a whole nother category that we've had to live with for 400 years.
In terms of my point, it's audio by Jahan, subtitles by Scoop Jackson, because you just explained it like, perfectly.
The Rolling Stones, in 1972, at one of the heights of their popularity, I might have been the Sticky Fingers tour, it might have been the Exile on Main Street tour, but the opening act for that tour was Stevie Wonder, Inner Vision Stevie Wonder. Is that a form of acknowledgement by taking an artist, Stevie Wonder, who was already huge in Black America, Black American music, and giving him a platform that the Rolling Stones have, which arguably was much larger than Stevie's platform, and exposing their audience to his music? Is that a form of acknowledgement?
You know, what I will say is I only really became alive to this type of music in the last couple of years. So
Scoop's looking at me like, oh, hell no.
I'll say that the one thing I haven't really, I'm not really intimately familiar with the history of these groups. I'm familiar only with their discographies. But what I'll say is that I think they don't ever seem to have shied away from publicly stating their love for black music, particularly Jimmy Page and Keith Richards. They've been so vocal about how they learned, where they learned, what they love, etc. So I don't doubt that they love Stevie Wonder. I don't doubt that they love Willie Dixon. I don't doubt that they love Howling Wolf, but Billy Preston, you know, I don't doubt it.
And it depends, Arthur, on their intent. To me, that's the answer to your question. It's just intent. If their intent was to, yay, we love Stevie and we love to, like, you know, have it be a part of what we're doing just out of our love for us because our audience may not be listening to it and they need to be listening to it, fine. But if their intent was, oh, let's help this little black dude out and give him a wider audience, with white, which white artists and white people tend to do all the time, when they think, because they associate everything, they associate everything with greatness to numbers. And Stevie would have been fine without the Rolling Stones doing anything for him. He would have been fine. He may not have needed that. But if their intent was to, oh, let's help this little black dude out, then that's where it becomes problematic. We don't know what their intent was. And they'll never say what their intent was. But white artists and white individuals do this all the time. They look at the fact that they have millions of people following them, and then black people have a couple of hundred thousands, and they feel like, oh, we can help these little black people out and give them this and introduce them. But that ain't what we're looking for. You know what I'm saying? We didn't ask you for that. Right. And we and don't try to absolve your guilt out of trying to do something for us, because what you're doing is not for us. It's for you. So that all is rooted in what their intent is.
This reminds me of the Beatles bringing, who did they bring over? Was it Muddy Waters they brought over? Or was it Howlin' Wolf they brought over and had him play? And I think there's an interview the Beatles said, like, hey, don't y'all know? Because I think journalists were asking them about, you know, the music they listen to. And he's like, we listen to American music. Don't y'all know about these black artists? Mm. So I feel like, are we upset at the artists, or are we upset at the music labels and the fans for not recognizing these things? Because obviously the Beatles and the Rolling Stones have said how much they love these artists, and they're trying to put them out on Front Street. But it's really the fans that are like, oh, so that stuff is right in our own backyard. Is that what we're upset at? The reaction to it? It kind of reminds me, I think it was 90. When did House of Pain's Jump Around come out? Was that 90?
Yeah, that's about right, 90, 91.
Living in 94? Either way.
I thought, whatever, yeah.
That album, that record comes out, and every, you know, being from Wheaton, Illinois, every white kid on my block heard that House of Pain song and thought it was the greatest thing in the world. And I heard it, I'm like, oh, this is like Public Enemy, you know? Right. I've heard this before, but the reaction to it.
That happened with the Beastie Boys with License to Ill.
Yes. Yeah. The reaction to it was, oh, this is being filtered through something different. And I think sometimes, I feel like I'm hearing, and John and Scoop, y'all can tell me if I'm, you know, interpreting this correctly. Are we not upset at people's reaction to the music to it?
You know, I think you're right.
Or is it the artist?
No, I think we could be upset with it, but we have to understand the history of music and how it goes with, especially white artists doing quote unquote black music and white fan bases finding a connection to that. You know what I'm saying? In a way that they don't, that is very similar to what we do. Now, if we're really getting into the nuance of this, as much as the Beastie Boys, License to Ill, sounded like Raising Hell by Run DMC, as much as House of Pain tried to come off as sounding like, you know, a Public Enemy situation, as much as Action Bronson likes to want to sound like Ghostface Killah, whatever you want to do with that, there's some small nuance of whiteness, which may be a lack of soul, that's in that music that connects to white people in a way.
In those
that
examples.
Makes them gravitate to it differently. Now, we can't be mad at them, but they purposely connect to it. You know, and Jump Around is a classic example, because in dealing with that, black people don't jump when we dance. White people do. We slide, we glide, we move. That jump shit is them.
Is it the word around? Can I ask you, is it the word around that you got a problem with, because it has some random kind of like feature to it?
But
like
just... it probably does. But there's
on the real though, there's
a sound.
Literally jumping around.
Yeah.
Right.
You really want
there's
it.
No rhythm to it around. Yeah.
Yeah, but if you listen to the vocal, if you listen to how they sound, if you listen to the phrasing and the word terminology, you know that the MC, without seeing the video, and the video had a lot to do with Jump Around being popular, because you got a whole Irish band, Irish ball, all that stuff, so they connected that too. But if you just listen to that, listen to it lyrically, you know that's not a black artist. White audiences do too. There's a connectivity that's missing there from us to them that they feel when their own artists do our music. That's why we can't really get mad at them, because that's been consistent through history. That's why Elvis hit harder than James Brown. That's why Donnie and the Osmonds hit fire differently than the Jacksons. You know what I'm saying? That's why New Kids on the Block and them hit harder than New Edition. We could go through all of the same white artists that do our music, but they become more popular with white audiences and white fan bases because of what's missing that they connect to. So we can't really be mad at them. That's what they, that's now. I'm not saying that they don't purposely do that. I think there's some purpose there in which they're like, oh, if I can get a white version of this, I'm going to gravitate to it. But there's still some connectivity there. And we can even go to Eminem and his the content in which he writes things. He connects lyrically to them in subject matters that we don't fuck with. You know, that killing family members. Now, we'll kill each other in the streets and all this shit, but drowning your wife and killing your kid, all that crazy ass, I'm on all type of drug shit that Eminem does, that white folks get down with. We don't get with that. But his lyrical content, they fuck with all day. So they, and we can't get mad at the audience about that unless they purposely do it. That's my point.
let me move to Tina Marie. Probably one of maybe five.
So
black, white people. You know what I'm saying?
Right, like, that's what I'm about to say. Tina Marie, that's a whole other like, conversation, because
this her is being
white
be our...
Right. I don't know anybody that looks at Tina Marie as white, though. That's different.
There's a couple things here. Tina Marie. I respect Tina Marie as an artist, but when I hear Tina Marie, I only hear Rick James. I only hear Rick James. I don't know what Tina Marie sounds like without Rick James.
The crazy thing is that Rick James don't produce her shit.
Dottie, that's a bit unfair, bro.
Right.
But no. I get that. And I knew that was coming. But it's I only hear the funk and the style inspiration of him there. And so that's why I wanted to bring up, like, when there's someone behind the artist, how does that fit in there?
Well, that's a good point, especially with, it depends on who is behind that particular artist. And Rick James is such a commodity that we hold on to as black people. You know, Rick James was not a crossover. Rick James was ours. And Alma, he's like a one-man Isley brother. Like, look, this is Oz. Y'all are never going to understand this. Y'all ain't touching this. So Rick James is a black royalty with us. So with her coming from him in that camp, it almost is like, all right, well, we'll take her. You know, no, if he co-signs for her, she's official. Like, so we embrace, like, her in that. Now, you have to be a certain type
though,
of black individual.
She delivered.
Oh, and that's the point. That's the point I'm trying to make. Is that she already got the cosign from him. Now, there could be another black artist that doesn't have that same type of connection to black audiences the way Rick James does, that could do the exact same thing, and they don't get that acceptance the way Tina Marie does. But the one thing that gives Tina Marie, I think, an authenticity about everything she did is that she never deviated from that. She didn't do like a lot of these other white artists that we're going to wind up talking about, where they took, you know, their detour. Toes or their little fingertips and dipped into black music and then went back and did some other
stuff. She was in it.
Tina stayed true to who that introduction was, and that's why she got accepted. So that's why, like Arthur said, Rick never produced anything by her. She did her own thing. That helped with black folks accepting her. And unlike Donnie, we heard Tina for what we knew that she was. Like, she was a black artist. Like, that was it. White folks, no, y'all ain't got that. We got, like, in the Dave Chappelle draft, she ours. She ours all day.
But now, to address Donnie, you know, the idea of, okay, you know, here's this white group, but in this group, there are black members. So, to me, a poster child for what you're talking about is Steely Dan. And Steely Dan, as we really know Steely Dan, was really two guys, Donald Fagen, Walter Brecker, and a host of session musicians. You know, Patty Austin is on background, you know, sometimes, you know, damn near duetting with Donald Fagen, you know, and these are on our radio stations, so-called urban terrestrial stations, along with, you know, other artists like Boz Scaggs, for example, Daryl Hall, Hall & Oates, and, oh, sweet Jesus, the Doobie Brothers, you know, Michael McDonald, another one of the five white black people. Like,
and soulful as hell. I mean, soulful as, it's not just about the songs he's singing, it's not just about whether those songs are compositionally catchy or dope songs. Soulful as hell. Who ain't gonna, you know, he's so soulful that, I mean, Donnie and I were laughing about this last week, but so soulful that basically, if you go to any kind of karaoke situation, whatever, or if the, or even if a Michael McDonald song comes on the radio, whatever race you are, you're gonna put on the Michael McDonald voice when you That's sing it.
You are. You can't not do that.
You can't not do that.
With these kinds of groups, we're talking about the concept known as the pass. They get a pass.
But why do they get a pass? Is it a respect? Is it respect in the production? And not the production. It's a respect in their delivery.
I think it's a respect in the approach to the material.
I think it's a respect. And you mentioned Hall & Oates, which I think they're a separate subject because they're a different case study, I think. But I think for the most part, a lot of these groups we're talking about get a pass because if you look at the music that they do, it's consistently geared towards not just their style, but a certain genre. I think the pass comes with that. I think if you saw the Doobie Brothers trying to lean outside of that black lane, mm-hmm. then their pass wouldn't be there. You know, they didn't have just one or two or three songs played on black radio or they made the black charts. Their career was rooted in, quote unquote, making black music, and they did mm-hmm. not leave that. And I think that's where the pass comes in. Like, oh, you know what? Because we know white artists, especially really good white artists, especially white artists that have the ability to do soul music, they can go out and do some pop music and get paid. It's easy for them. So the fact that they don't, that's when they get that pass from that black artist. Like, oh man, you can go out and do this, but just choosing to stay here, then we accept that.
We know it's genuine.
Right, then it's mm-hmm. genuine. That's mm-hmm. who you are. Mm-hmm. But when you start doing other things, that's when that pass is like, nah, you just messing with us just to take advantage of a situation. No, we can't give you a pass. We're going to put you over here. And that's what, to me, makes Hall & Oates. Well, to me, first, the classic example of all the groups you mentioned are Average White Band. Because they never, ever, ever left out of that. Like, they never even dabbled into a pop situation. You will see more black. I've never been to an Average White Band concert. I've been to like seven of them and seen any white people. Any. Yeah. Like, they do their thing, and they are true up front with who they are, but they've never let that, so they get their pass. But Hall & Oates, to me, is a unique case study because they get a pass in black culture and in black music because of the music they do. Now, they're from Philly. They from, I want to say South Philly, but they both went to Temple. I know that much. So they're innocent. They are two of those white boys that are hood. But they make black music that is specifically for us, about us, and it's from them. But they also do music that white people accept. You know what I'm saying? We don't hold that against them because we know how true they are. We just give them credit for being just a dope-ass duo.
So if you give us one jam,
because it doesn't like it, and it's not like their songs are really different. It's not like they're making two different types of music. So this is just the Hall & Oates sound, and this happened to be one of those songs that, hey, white people felt this. We didn't feel this, but we feel this. You know what I'm saying? So they're a unique case study in this because they're one of the few white groups that really gets a pass and gets acceptance from us. And white people, like, love to death at the same time for two different reasons.
Two different reasons, yeah.
Two different reasons.
I mean, I'm sure that's true of a lot of artists. That's true of Prince too, right?
Yes.
No.
Exactly. Yes, no, exactly.
What are you talking about? What songs What songs are like completely separate like that?
Let's go crazy.
Exactly. Thank you, John.
Huh. I learned something today.
So, but look, okay. Because black audiences, you know, we are not monolithic. But take an artist like Joni Mitchell, who I would arguably say doesn't set out to do black music.
Yeah, I agree with you.
I was about to say Dusty Springfield too, but that's a good one.
Oh, you know what? We can talk about some Dusty Springfield. But Joni Mitchell has a high degree of respect from black audiences who might not be heavy into her catalog.
Sure. Right. You're right.
I always got the impression that she didn't necessarily set out to see herself in a particular genre. I always got the impression that she just set out to put what was in her head and heart on paper and on tape. And what influences her at particular times comes out. You know, her associations, you know, Don Alias, etc. And then perhaps that leads to Matheny and Jaco and Herbie and Wayne. Mm-hmm. I don't know how much of it was actively sought. When you talk about, you know, stuff like Hijira, I don't know how much of that was sought out deliberately and how much of it was just like her at the time.
But we have to keep in mind that black people, black audiences, us, sometimes it doesn't take much. It doesn't take a whole career. And we're, like I said, we're not monolithic, and we're not monolithic in just acceptance. We're not monolithic in the way we behave. So just as we're talking about we stay true to those who we feel stay true to us, there are some artists, and we white artists, that have done like one single song, and that's their pass. Mm-hmm. Boss Gags, Lowdown, mm-hmm. he gets a pass just for that mm-hmm. one song. Look, that's all we needed to hear. Just for one damn song. Uh-huh. That's it. Loggers and Messina, the same thing. Pathway to Glory. And Arthur, you've been here. Donnie, you know, that's a stepping classic. But you ask, man, I fuck with Kenny Loggers. No, you don't. You fuck with one song Kenny Loggers did. But that's all he needed to do.
That's enough.
Can I mention one group? Like, it's just like a 5-second thing, because I just think that a lot of people will dig it. If you like Michael McDonald, if you like Hall & Oates, there's a group that you must check out. It's called Pages. They did 3 albums. All 3 albums, in my opinion, impeccable. I didn't know them until a good friend of mine turned me onto them a couple of years ago. But they're just like tune after tune after tune. So, so, so dope. And interestingly, I think they didn't have any success. So 2 of the members of Pages went on to create Foreigner, the band, and of course had huge success with them. Wow. But the Pages stuff is completely, like, you would never believe it was the same cats. Mm. Never.
Okay, wow. So let me try to speed this up, because
we're having too much fun.
It's supposed to be brief, and this ain't brief. Okay, take an artist like Madonna. I was good to go with her first album, but her second album, Like a Virgin, which really is what catapulted her into stardom, was produced by Nile Rodgers. Nile Rodgers, if you're unfamiliar, is one of the founding members of Chic. He was producing Diana Ross, you know, Upside Down, I'm Coming Out, that Diana Ross, that's Nile Rodgers. David Bowie's Let's Dance, that album is Nile Rodgers.
Sister Sledge.
Damn, he got paid.
Yeah, goddamn, you know? But, you know, and I mean, we're talking about a vehicle for young white woman vocalist that is projecting herself through rhythm and blues, but aimed squarely at the pop charts. George Michael is another artist like that. As he moved away from Wham, does this ballad Careless Whispers that don't sound nothing like Wake Me Up Before You Go-Go, and then that sets him up for Faith, which is everything a black album should be minus the black male vocalist, right?
Absolutely. Yep.
So now, how much of this is co-opting? How much of this is appreciation? And how much of this is black creators getting a payday because they've got a white artist fronting their music.
Shoot, that's going to be the next few people on the list, to be honest with you.
Yeah. And let me say this real quick. I think Madonna, for me, is a little bit different because you use the word co-opting. The first thing that comes to my mind when I hear her has always been Colonizer. And it goes back to the first album because I watched her, basically, it wasn't black music. It was dance music at the time.
Right.
And the way
right.
she used dance music in New York,
yep.
that is basically another extension of black music and Puerto Rican music at the time. And the way she took, like, Jelly Bean Benitez and all the sounds that were coming out of clubs back then and then paraded that as pop music. And then she went to Nile Rodgers. I'm like, yo, this is a pattern. This isn't by mistake. This is designed to take what we have inside of our independent black Latino culture mm-hmm. and put it out there with a white face on it. You know, and she's from Detroit. So she's like really a colonizer. It always has been mm-hmm. in my mind. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't about Nile Rodgers getting a payday because he was getting paid either way. It was going to happen. But it was her like, oh, what's the hot black producer? Let's do this. Oh, what's the hot black DJ? So Nile Rodgers was not an anomaly. She started her career doing that and bought it into it. She continued to do that throughout, all the way to Babyface.
Scoob, let me ask you something, man. Is there a difference between being a, what's the word you use, colonizer, right? Is there a difference between being a colonizer and having your finger on the pulse?
To me, yes. And I will say that the difference in situations like that is your finger on the pulse or is your finger connected to the pulse? Hmm. And in Madonna's situation, you are an outsider with your finger on somebody else's pulse. Like you're going into somebody else's area, somebody else's culture, and putting your finger on their pulse. And once you get the pulse, you're leaving. And I'm dipping back in. So I hear what you're saying. So and race plays a lot in that too.
But if you have a genuine love for something, or let's talk about it this way. Let's say a black artist didn't grow up around any of this, but once they heard it in their teenage years or their early 20s or whenever it was, they were captured by it. But they didn't grow up around any of this. They didn't learn any of it. They weren't part of any of it growing up. But they really into the music. They listen to the radio, they go to the clubs, etc., and they got their finger on the pulse. But they're black. Does that change things?
Once again, going to what I said earlier about our history and having our art and our creativity always, you know, taken by other people, then yeah, it does mm-hmm. change for me. Mm-hmm. You know, apart the answer to your question, a lot of it is rooted in race, and it's also rooted in position. And if you really want to get down to it, Jahan, it's rooted in power.
Sure.
Because at
sure.
the end of the day, who are the mm-hmm. people that are signing these
for
artists?
For sure, for sure.
Who are the
for
people
sure.
that are running the record labels and distribution? Who's putting them on tour? Right. So if you want to get to where we play a role in this, the finger on the pulse is important. But once it leaves the pulse, it gets whiter and whiter and whiter and whiter, and it's further removed
yeah,
from us
the
being the pulse of that.
I think that's the answer.
So yeah, race plays a role in it. Yeah.
You know, something else that's yeah. interesting to me is like in establishing kind of like an authentic connection to black music, one of the most beautiful aspects about black music to me is the ballad or the slow jam. Sometimes you can look at some of the artists that we're talking about and it seems to be harder, or at least just to my taste anyway, it seems to be harder to convincingly do a slow jam or a ballad than it is to do an up-tempo dance track.
Good point.
And yeah, that kind of separates the, you know, that separates people, the yep. men from the boys, if you want to.
It does.
You
know. It really does. That's a hard, because you're dealing with emotion as opposed to style and creativity.
And there's more of you on display. Like, you can't really hide yeah. behind the drum beat. You can't really hide behind the rhythm or the energy of the track. And as your voice, is right. more, your voice is more on display.
But you have to connect to something mm-hmm. emotionally also. Like, there's a certain level of pain that we bring to the table from our blues to our slow music. And you have to be able to deliver that. And if it's not there, that's something you can't fake.
But George Michael could do it, though, right?
George Michael just flat out sing. There's no doubt about it. George Michael,
I mean, like, one more try.
Arthur, you could do it for Kissing one song.
Fool, Last Request.
Yeah, you could do it for one song. It's fine. But you cannot base a career.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so you can't base a career off of doing it. That's the difference between Led Zeppelin's Stairway to Heaven mm-hmm, and the sure. OJ's Stairway to Heaven.
But Tina, though, Tina
you know
Ballads.
What I'm saying? Something...
I mean, that's honestly, to be honest with you, I could probably name more Tina Ballads than up-tempo tracks.
Tina's the exception to the rule.
Because Tina ain't white, right?
Right. Thank you. That's all I'm saying.
Can I ask real quick before we go on, is there a difference between UK white artists doing that
be.
And American white artists?
But I think there is, but go ahead.
I don't know, man. I get that they shouldn't be. But yeah, I do feel that European audiences are much more appreciative. Is too cheap a word.
That's a good word,
but,
though.
You know, they're more engaged in the music than white American audiences.
But the same could be said about European, you know, white European musicians. They have a greater acceptance of black music than we do, white artists do over here in America.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They really
yeah.
do. I mean, we could go through a list of all of these artists that we were talking about earlier and their connection to black music, and at least you give them credit for acknowledging to a certain degree that these artists exist. You know, that there's some existence in where we came from. And most of those are coming from UK artists.
Yeah, so I guess, man, I mean, like, with groups like Jamiroquai, I just feel like there's a certain appreciation, almost study. We want to play this music. How do you play it? Right? And then it's like, okay, we have the technique. Now what's the feel for it?
Well, here's the thing I think we need to start looking at how and why we judge in these particular situations. And I think, to me, it goes down to, okay, if a white artist decides to use black music as a foundation for their creativity, and in doing that, over the course of either their career or years, they do not find a certain level of success, where they don't get a pop success, or they don't see the results of their music finding a certain level of success, but they still stay true to that form of music. That's when I think we say, okay, they're not colonizers. They're not just dipping their toe in. They're not just putting their finger on the pulse. They are true to this being their creativity and black music being connected as a foundation to their creativity.
I wonder if country music has these kinds of conversations that we're having. And I say that, you know, I was talking about Taylor Swift, and she really started, you know, as a country artist, got to a level and then left. And country, you know what, on the real, country music by and large has brought a lot to the table as far as pop music is concerned.
I don't know. I think country has a foundation of staying country that they don't. I think they look at Taylor Swift as, okay, you know, you did your thing, you let go, but you're not going to affect anything we're doing. We're still going to be fine. From the Blake Sheltons to the Lady Antebellums, you know, mm-hmm. Country mm-hmm. music is so rooted, especially here in America, with their television contract that they have, mm-hmm. where there seems to be a CMA every 3 months. You know, and you're right.
Uh-huh.
Seriously, their platform is extremely strong that whatever Taylor does not affect them and their culture music. We're fine. We have enough artists in here to make this thing go, and we have enough support, internal and external, to make that go. So I think they're two different situations we're talking about.
You mentioned Taylor Swift. From what I understand about her, she's a songwriter, right? She writes her songs.
Yeah.
So
yes.
what about one of the most famous songwriters of black music of all time, Rod Temperton?
What about him?
Where does he stand in this argument? In this discussion?
Well, I'll say this, and I know I've been talking a lot, but I think Rod gets a pass somewhat, not only because of what he did with Heatwave, and his band goes into that lane where I think they never deviated from trying to use black music as their foundation and never tried to do anything pop, never tried to do anything outside of what they did. They stayed in this lane and were comfortable in there and never left that. And when Rod did leave that, his direct connection stayed within black music, mm-hmm. especially with the Quincy Jones thing. So as we look at Tina Marie and like, all right, if Rick James got her, she's good. It's kind of, you know, the same way with Quincy Jones. All right, we appreciate what Heatwave is doing and we love everything Heatwave does. But now you get outside of Heatwave and your your connection is still locked into black music with Quincy Jones, you good, dude.
Interpreter.
You a good old, we have no problem with that.
He's an so Englishman, I think, right? I think he's Rock unique. Temperton?
Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah. Yorkshire.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially
and I'm saying, but that's Quincy
stuff.
Jones. Yeah, that's right. But when you're doing that, and you know, Ra was a big part of probably Michael connected to a black audience.
Sure.
Especially on Off the Wall.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody needed to keep Michael in that black groundedness. And a lot of that we know was Ra Temperton.
Yeah.
And Greg Philogenus also. But basically Ra Temperton. Yeah. Right. So Ra to me gets a pass. Yeah, he's in the Ra Temperton to me is in the Tina Marie lane, I think.
All right, let's say Sting and the Police. And even, you know, a group like Red Hot Chili Peppers, who are really a funk outlet.
Are or were?
You know, listening to their album that came out, they still have that foundation.
Yeah, I mean, Mother's Milk, Freaky Styley,
yeah.
Blood Sugar Sex Magik.
Californication.
Well, no, that's the thing. One Hot Minute, Californication, I don't know, is that...
Oh, they're in it. But left it.
So you think the Red Hot Chili Peppers, they were wearing the coat for a little while, then they put the coat in the closet.
I don't want to say it that disparagingly. I mean, and I think, you know what, to be fair, also, like, let's not forget, it's cool for an artist to evolve sometimes, right? Like, Scoop answered it perfectly in the beginning, intent, in terms of your acceptance and then your departure from something. It's okay for an artist to want to explore something else, to want to do something different. We've talked before quite extensively about Michelle and Degocello, for example. Plantation Lullabies, Peace Beyond Passion, and then Bitter. It's different. And, you know, we can either agree or disagree that it was still black music, whatever. But I think artists can evolve and artists can go in different directions. So I don't necessarily think every instance of an artist going into a different territory musically is, you know, an intentional kind of disrespect or discarding or devaluing.
And that's why
I think
this situation and the subject matter is so unique, because there's really no wrong answer, and all answers are different across the board. You know, you mentioned Red Hot Chili Peppers, and I think they're a great example, but let's add a component to them that I think is necessary that we haven't really talked about. The power of black radio and black charting.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't remember. Now, we know musically, Red Hot Chili Peppers are basically a funk band. But they've never, ever had a single or an album that was charted on black charts, on the R&B charts, and never had any single or song that had regular rotation on black radio.
Is that true, though? Like Give It Away?
Not on black radio. Not like that. Not like that.
Really?
Nah.
Not on black radio.
Not
I would
on
say
black radio,
people
no.
knew about it, though.
Yeah, they knew about it, but not on black radio. And here's my thing. To juxtapose that to what Arthur said. The Police and Sting, two totally different things. They have had songs that have found a lot of time over the course of their career on black radio.
You know what? The fact that they didn't chart on any black chart, that really speaks to how open our ears are, because we all dug it. We all loved it at that time, right? It didn't matter that it was only on an alternative chart. And it's funny because I think the mainstream sort of sees it the other way. They kind of assume that we only listen to, you know, R&B or hip hop or whatever else. And
true.
This is certainly if you're part of Generation X, you know, you were all over this
right,
shit.
Right.
Smells
no,
like Teen
right.
Spirit probably working that same vein, right? Black people love that, but it never got any black charts at all.
So I wasn't just singling the charts out, because the charts basically kind of deal with popularity. But when radio chooses you, black radio, especially across the country, when you start making black radio and R&B playlists and getting heavy rotations, like Every Breath You Take did. Like, what was Sting's first solo song when he left the...
If You Love Somebody, Set Them Free.
If You Love Somebody, right, exactly. That, man, come on. Those things were rooted in black music, and they found themselves on black charts, and you found them in heavy rotation on black radio.
You cats were asking about... Before we started taping? You guys were asking about personnel in a band. Like, if a white lead artist has several black band members, you know, what does that do to the discussion or to the evaluation of their material? I mean, the Police, Sting, of course, it's three white guys, but when you look at Sting's solo career, possibly the greatest pop band of all time, we're talking about, you know, Omar Hakim, Kenny Kirkland, Branford Marsalis, Daryl Jones. I mean, you know, like, this is you know, killing ass territory.
But think about it, is that they were so accepted by the black community that the transition did not seem fake.
Mm-hmm.
This is just a question, actually, because I don't know the answer. Do you think it was less of a jump for Sting from The Police to his solo stuff than George Michael from Wham to his solo
without
stuff?
Question.
To Faith. I think
without
so, too.
Question.
Yeah,
without question. Without question.
Even, and it, what's really interesting is that Sting actually, it's funny because while I 100% agree with what you just said, Scoop, with your answer, stylistically, you could argue that Wham stuff is kind of looking at R&B. The Police was kind of more of a reggae thing. Ska and reggae.
Yeah, ska.
But then Sting's
ska
solo
reggae,
stuff
exactly.
is much more, what, you know, I don't want to use the J word, but it's much more, you know, black American music. You know, J-A-Z-Z. But, yeah.
Wham was so poppy.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and not necessarily for their music, but definitely their look that associated itself with the music. That made it harder. That made the transition harder for George Michael to
seriously.
Come into our cultural lane than Sting coming from a reggae band. You know what I'm saying? I think that made a difference. I'm sorry, go ahead, Donnie.
Everything She Wants got played on Video Soul.
Yeah, no,
so,
no doubt
I mean,
about
there
it.
There was a pass there. I didn't think the jump was that. I mean, from that song, I didn't think. And Carol, I didn't think that was that.
Yeah,
much
but
of a
you,
jump.
But you can't unsee "Wake Me Up Before You Go Go." You cannot unsee that, dude.
Good point.
Is Sade a white band or a black band?
That's what. Okay, I'm glad you mentioned
Ooh.
That. Now, I'm glad you mentioned it.
See,
that's way better than what I was going to say. Let's talk about that.
Sade is a black.
Wait, hey Donnie, you're like this, Donnie. This is the first time in this show I'm gonna be quiet because I don't have an answer.
Go on, Donnie. The risk is on your shoulders, bro.
Oh no! Don't I? See, I don't know. I don't know the intricacies of how they, as a band, they came up with their sound and everything. But I've always seen them as a black band. I can't not see them as not a black band because the music filtered through their lead singer. Just
that's a good way to say it.
But even without Sade Adu as Sweetback, they stayed in that same lane. And I mean, man, I mean Sweetback, I kind of see them as a template for what we see now in say Moonchild. Or even Bad,
yeah,
Not
okay.
Good.
You know what? I'm not.
That's
okay.
A good connection.
I'm not mad at
that. When Sade came out, I was a teenager in the Bay Area. So I wasn't in Chicago. Obviously, I was in the Bay Area in California. But what I'm saying is, when I first heard Sade, it was not on a black radio station as we traditionally know it.
It was
not
like on a double
station,
right?
It was, right.
It was a jazz station.
Right.
Yeah.
It was on KBLX. And they were being programmed right alongside Al Jarreau, Yellow Jacket, Weather Report, Michael Franks. You see what I'm saying? And that's how I was exposed. And I didn't realize that they were a thing like that. Like, my mom bought the album. Like, my mom was like a heavy Sade fan.
Same,
but I'm saying, like,
same.
My mom bought the album. I didn't know Sade was a big deal until I saw Live Aid on TV and Sade was performing.
That's because I heard Sade in a black club. You know, the first song, Hang On To Your Love, that bass line was something that was played. Mm-hmm. You know, I was in New Orleans at the time. And it's like, whoa. But they promoted her as a jazz artist, though. If you remember when she came out.
Exactly.
And my father's like, that ain't jazz. And he's one of these jazz purists. So, you know, he's like, that ain't no goddamn jazz. I ain't listening to her. What is
it? This was kind of the height of that whole smooth jazz kind of takeover.
It was before that. The format was called Quiet Storm.
Right.
I was introduced to her by a fine-ass French babysitter.
I knew that was coming.
who had Stronger Than Pride on cassette. And listen... Uh-huh. I was in love on two counts.
I'm not going to remember anything else from this podcast except that.
Except
right
that.
Sorry.
Hey, but listen, alongside everybody that I spoke of, Sade was getting airplay right next to Kenny G getting airplay on the same station.
This is where the conversation starts. What was his huge joint that was like took over everything? Number one, Songbird, right?
Yes.
Can I ask you a question real quick? Can I ask you, and it's really dealing with what we're talking about right now, because you made me think of something. Okay. Explain why, as a white artist, Kenny G did not necessarily get acceptance in the black community, but David Sanborn did.
Have you ever read Pat Metheny's takedown of Kenny G?
No, I haven't.
The answer is there.
I'm pretty sure it was you know, well deserved.
I'm gonna say because black audiences found out that Kenny G can't play, David Sanborn can.
Okay.
No, I don't.
I see Donnie contemplating. Hey, how many Kenny G records do you have, Donnie?
Me, none. And I'm trying not to use my. I'm not trying not to bust my father on this because my father had some Kenny G albums. Uh-huh. So I was. I'm of the impression that I didn't think this is maybe my first time hearing that black people didn't mess with Kenny G. I think black people do.
You really do, for real?
I think so.
You know what? I think Donnie's right because I think there's a whole cohort of people who basically they think that that lets them tick jazz off of their list. Basically, ooh, I love jazz.
Yeah,
I've got a cocktail in my hand and I'm looking out over a New York skyline and this TV dinner jazz is.
Yeah,
playing.
Kenny G is a easy
jazz. I just got that.
That's Swanson's jazz, right?
Yeah. That Hungry Man jazz. Go ahead.
It really allows people to, yeah. John is right. It really allows people to have that, to check that off. And it's an easy entry into it because Songbird was played everywhere. So
everywhere.
It's everywhere.
You couldn't escape it at that point.
I highly recommend y'all check out the documentary on Kenny G because it illuminates a lot about his personality that I did not know about. But one of the most illuminating things in the film is the director or someone asked him about his influences and they asked him, what do you think of John Coltrane? And you would think someone like Kenny G is a saxophone player, horn player, jazz player.
Started because, right.
Right. And he was like, you know, I don't really listen to him that much. Well, he wasn't really much of an influence. And so that to me just, and I don't hate Kenny G like that. I mean, he's whatever. But that to me told me a lot. And it I think it hits on our conversation here about appreciation, because he's out there selling all these records and playing all this music. And there are a lot of white audience, you know, he has a huge white audience, but there's a black audience there too. But he's admitting that he didn't come from the cloth of one of the greatest. And so I found that very illuminating. But if you watch the documentary, I think you see and maybe understand why he may not understand that. But that was a very illuminating part of that film. So anyone listening, I think you should definitely check it.
I'm gonna do that.
But it would be bad if he did listen to John Coltrane and steal the shit that comes out of his saxophone like that. So he did the right thing by at least admitting it up front.
Yeah. Hey, but look, Jahan, you brought up Pat Metheny.
Yeah.
And so my dad, I was introduced to Pat Metheny through my dad, and it was like Still Life Talking Pat Metheny. So it wasn't the earlier ECM releases. Saying that to say, so like the 87, 88, 89 Pat Metheny group albums were really heavy into South American polyrhythms. And you could almost make the argument that Pat Metheny co-opted that whole sound in the same way that Paul Simon co-opted South African music with Graceland, you know, and won a Grammy and, you know, got all these accolades.
You're talking like Still Life Talking and Letter From Home and...
I'm talking about Still Life Talking and Letter From Home. Really those two, yeah. Does Pat Metheny get a pass on that score?
So there's some programming that I don't like on those albums.
To my La Maze's synths?
Maybe a couple of things.
Oh, okay.
That's just the time. That's like late 80s. That was just happening, right? It was just a thing that people were experimenting with. Perhaps kind of parallel to Joni Mitchell. I think when you're an exploratory artist, you're an exploratory artist. Like, that's what you do. I've never heard, or let me say this. I don't think there's any serious performer who would question Pat Metheny's dedication to music. Or Bill Evans, or
right,
or Keith Jarrett.
Regardless of who it reaches, right, Jahan?
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. these are people who have dedicated, literally dedicated their lives.
They've earned it.
Having this instrument become an extension of them physically, you know, and psychologically and mentally, spiritually. I would never question his intent. Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. I think he's just somebody who adores music. You know, it's part of his it's part of his respiratory system. And it's just the most mm-hmm. natural thing in the world for him to explore.
But I also think it's how you feel. How do you feel about it? Even if you're not well versed or well immersed into a certain sound or musical sound, if it feels authentic to you, and that's the power of music.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? If it feels authentic to you, then that's what you ride on. Yeah. You're like, hey, I don't know Brazilian music like that, but this feels like what I think Brazilian music is.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And if you have a taste for music, you know what that feeling is, and that's what you roll with.
And you know, Scoop, we've talked about that before.
We have.
In a different disguise when we talked about Donald Glover and Awaken My Love. Mm-hmm. There was something for us that just didn't feel like...
Right, exactly.
Just didn't feel like funkadelic, no matter what it was dressed up like.
Okay, here, but let me say this right now. We have not taken a dive into jazz, actually, and we have not taken a dive into hip-hop. Do we want to continue going, or do we want to split this up and do a part two to give these other sections time to breathe and continue this conversation on it? Because...
Yeah, I can't get it all in.
Okay.
But let me just say, speaking to jazz, 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, I learned that Keith Jarrett is not black.
You said that on the text.
Arthur thought I was crazy.
Yeah. I was reading this list. I'm like, why you got Keith Jarrett on here? Listen. Black, I woke my wife up. I'm like, Keith Jarrett, why? He's not black? He's white man? Okay.
Right.
We don't have time to get through all the artists that are on this list. So we're going to put a pin in this conversation. We're going to call this part one, and we'll come back and we'll do a part two and drill down on definitely jazz, most definitely hip hop, and probably some other stuff that got pushed to the side. But we have a round table for this episode. This show's question: what one singer did not appear on the 1985 charity hit single, We Are the World, but should have been included? Now, I emphasize should, because we can name a whole lot of people that might have had availability and all that, but didn't deserve to be on the, like we need you on this song. That's what I'm talking about. Who needed to be on We Are the World, but they were not?
Go on, Arthur. Arthur, lead us off.
Chaka Khan.
Yes! You got my answer. That's my
Ooh.
Answer. It's right. I got him shocking. That's it. Thank you.
That's,
I'm good.
That's
I'm
a great
good.
Answer.
That's my answer.
That's
Way
a
to go.
Great answer.
Way to go.
That's a really great answer.
That's
wow.
A great
that
answer.
Came out of, I wasn't even expecting that, because I was looking at the time. I looked at the list. Now, listen, are you saying Chaka? I want to add something to the roundtable. I want people to say who should have been included, but also were they a solo vocalist.
I'm gonna do even better. I'm gonna tell you who she should have replaced.
Dan Aykroyd.
Okay.
Huey Lewis.
There you go.
She should have. You would have had Chaka Khan coming immediately behind Michael Jackson.
Yeah, that could have worked.
That was the Prince part originally, right?
That could have worked. Yeah.
Yeah. Originally, it was supposed to be Michael and Prince. Prince didn't show up. So Quincy replaced Prince with Huey Lewis, who's on the record, coming behind Michael. And it's like a middle section of the song.
Yeah.
And then I think Cyndi Lauper comes behind Huey Lewis
that was
and
the bridge,
closes
right?
it out and goes into the chorus.
Exactly.
But if you
bridge,
put it, exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But I'm saying you put Chaka behind Michael. She's got the voice.
Oh, she can do it.
And Chaka was hot. Chaka had... I feel for you.
I feel for you.
She won a Grammy.
Like 6 months before, right?
Yeah. She was a draw. She was a legit draw. Now, no shade to Huey Lewis. That's kind of my guy. It was kind of like my thing in the early 80s. But I'm saying, Chaka behind Michael Jackson.
Can I add one more thing? Since I had the one point, I was waiting for you to make it, but you didn't make it. I want to add to your point.
Go ahead.
And Quincy did Rufus and Chaka Khan albums. He produced their albums for them. That's why I was like, Chaka is obvious, because that's one of Quincy's girls. That's one of his artists.
No, you're right.
There's
you're
no
right.
excuse. Yeah, yeah. She's the one.
I mean, that would have been... You can't argue with that. You can't argue with that. No one can argue with that, bro.
None.
Okay, so it's a full live. Y'all got nothing else?
I know, there's no argument there. She should have been there.
I always want someone to comment on, you know, our picks as part of the show. I never in my life thought about Shaka complimenting Michael's voice, but she really would.
Exactly. Mm. Exactly. Mm.
Do you think she wasn't included because the politics involved couldn't have too many black people? You had to balance it out a little bit, especially for the solos. Do you think about the music video?
I think you might be right that it was designed to be a mainstream hit to capture as many people as possible.
Yeah. Yeah.
But from what I've heard, they experienced something of a struggle for like 20 minutes in booking people, and then they just couldn't stop people calling, and everybody was like, oh, he's in, I'm in, she's in, I'm in. Within a short period of time, they had it locked. Availability probably was a big thing as well, like in terms of proximity, like who was in town. The American Music Awards, I think, were that night. Like, they deliberately scheduled it for the evening of the American Music Awards, so people would come straight from the ceremony to the studio. So whoever was attending that would have probably been on the first list just for ease and logistics.
But once again, they knew they were doing it. So if the artist wasn't there, they have the means to take a flight in just to be there for that situation.
Sure,
so
yeah, for
it
sure,
wasn't like
for
they
sure.
did this. They decided to do this while the American Music Awards were going on. They had this thing scheduled. So like I said, with Quincy sure. Jones already having a relationship with Shaka Khan, from a working standpoint, hey, Shaka, yeah, yeah. we're doing this thing. You know, get on in here. And I know you wanted a certain pop voice in there, but this is internal. This is family. If Quincy wants her in, she's in. It's really simple.
Scoop, did you have an alternate?
Yeah, I did. But I mean, you know what? I hate to say it. I like round tables, but I mean, why? I mean, everybody's like,
it's
why?
Like, why?
This is
right?
like a one-person round table. You nailed it, man. This is like, this is your walk-off home run, dude. Just
nailed
drop
it.
The bet. Flip the bet. It's over. It's done.
You know what's, I mean, you say that Shaka would have replaced Huey, and Huey was there in kind of standard 80s John Hughes attire, like, you know, white t-shirt,
yeah,
black blazer. Ain't it funny?
It was like, yeah.
I mean,
yeah,
not
yeah,
just
yeah.
Huey, but Huey standing next to Michael Jackson, but everybody in there with Michael Jackson, and they're all in normal clothes. Some of them have come directly from the venue. Some of them are wearing like sweatshirts and stuff. And Michael Jackson's in there like, I'm Michael Jackson all the goddamn time, baby.
You know what I mean? Yeah, he had the military jacket, had the sunglasses on.
Donnie, who you got? Who you got?
Mine, well, it's hard to top Shaka Khan now that I think about it. That's a great answer. I realized why mine wasn't in it because I just looked at when We Are The World came out. So We Are The World came out March 7th of 1985. It was recorded January 28th of 1985. And my pick, her album, had just come out.
I'm going to say
February of 85.
Yep, it was my second choice, but go ahead. I know what you're going to say.
So at first, when I looked at the list, I'm like, why isn't she on this?
Because
yep, she would have
yep,
a huge,
say the
perfect
name.
Voice. Amazing voice.
Say it. Say it.
Had this
say
been a
name.
Year later, she would have definitely been on We in the World. So
yep.
my choice was from New Jersey, Whitney Houston.
Number wow. two on my list, Whitney Houston.
But
number two on my list, Whitney Houston. She was the other one.
Number two on your list. See, that's why I need to go before y'all. But I get why Whitney Houston wasn't on the list because she hadn't
blown up yet.
She hadn't blown up yet. It hadn't hit yet. But I'm think about it. All of Michael Jackson's brothers and sisters were in the background. They made it, but Whitney couldn't get at least in the choir section of We Are the World.
Hey Donnie, let me say something else. We don't want to sit here and act like Clive Davis did not have the juice back then to get her on that project.
Talk about it. Yes.
There's, regardless of whether she blew up or not, Clive Davis would be like, hey, yo, we want her in the room. She's new. Mm-hmm. She's starting up. We want her in the room. And who's going to really say no? Especially with everybody understanding who Sissy is and every understanding who Dionne Warwick is. Oh, that's my goddaughter. Yeah, can she get in? And just because her album wasn't released.
Right.
And that's the one thing. That's why I put her at number two. It's like, just because her album released doesn't mean that them in the music industry did not know who she was. They knew who the fuck Whitney was. She should have been in there.
Right. She
should have
been
in
the room.
In that room. Without question. Now, and for the other reason, That was the safest collection of black musical artists you'll ever see in your life. Ever. There was not one threatening, dangerous.
Damn.
That was the safest black place ever. And if anybody picked that safe place.
Rick James wouldn't
right,
there.
Right. Rick James
you just,
wouldn't.
You just took my answer.
Wow.
You just took my answer.
Oh, what? Oh, I wouldn't. No. But John, I'm gonna be excited to hear your reasoning.
You took my answer, bro.
Go ahead, though.
Listen. All right. Let me. How do I make this more original now? How pissed was Rick James that he wasn't invited?
Too black, though.
He's too black. There it is. That's it. Really.
Way too black.
Rick looks at that room. He said, "I don't belong in that room." From a musical standpoint,
but
I
just
do.
Just tell me that, you know, that bridge, that section, that bridge where you have Cyndi Lauper do the, you know, that when we, that bit. What if that was Tina and Rick?
See, you playing. Jahan, you playing, man.
Like, Michael might be there in his aviators, but Rick's there in his leather.
Right.
You know what I mean? And
singing like he's singing 17.
If you know what I mean.
Yep, exactly. But let's be honest, though. Seriously, I like, Jahan, I'm with you, but let's be really honest. When I say safe, every black artist that was in that room, there is a sense of dependability. That we got you here, you're going to show up. You know, you look at...
Yeah, and respect for everybody else
right,
in the room
now,
also.
If you invite Rick James...
Yes.
And let's be honest, if you invite Chaka Khan, you know what I'm saying? You did. There are elements
good,
outside
you know
of it.
Yeah, but wait.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is it not fair to assume, none of us knowing these people, is it not fair to assume Chaka would have paid attention to the sign on the door? That sign that Quincy put up saying, "Leave your egos at the door." Chaka would have paid attention to that.
I think she would have because of the personal relationship with Quincy. If nothing else.
You know, she's looking at Ray Charles. She's looking at Harry Belafonte. She's looking at Al Jarreau. You know, these are people that she would regard as on her level, right?
But the idea that Michael, Prince, and Rick James would be on the same song is blowing my mind.
Yep.
You know what I'm saying?
Honestly. You had another one, John?
I had another name. And this is kind of like Chaka in the way that it don't make no sense. Michael McDonald.
Wait, he wasn't there?
Oh my goodness, yeah.
Hold on, that can't be right.
He had Keep Forgetting in 1982. Now, we got to remember, even though this was 1985, it was January 1985 that recorded it, right? January 1985.
Right.
Back then, things had such a long shelf life. These things will be on the charts for a while. They'll be on radio for even longer. But more than Keep Forgetting in 1982. In 1983, written by Rod Temperton, produced by Quincy Jones, and duetted by James Ingram, who was there, Michael McDonald had Yamo be there.
Mm-hmm.
Barely a year before.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
His voice and his kind of vibe, it seemed to be almost designed for this layout.
Yeah, Michael,
he would have checked several boxes by him being there. Voice, persona.
Yeah, yep. All right, I'm going to say mine, but the one I think should have been on there, but I know why he's not, I get it. But from a vocal standpoint, there's no reason for Luther Vandross not to be on that record.
Oh my gosh.
I'm going to use the same example that we did, the same reasoning that we did for Rick James.
I agree with you.
It's too black.
Yep. Too black. Yep.
Same reason.
But
he should have been there. You're right.
But Donnie,
it's too black though.
That's why I specified vocally. I said vocally. There's no reason Luther Vandross should not have been on their record.
I think the other part of it is they already had the writing aspect done, and Quincy's probably in there as a composer, as a vocal arranger.
Mm-hmm.
I see Luther. I've always respected Luther, the vocal arranger as well, and producer. And there's not a space for him there. So he can't just go and be a vocalist. I think he'd have to go and be Luther. And
damn, so he had had...
Okay.
Yeah.
He had had Never Too Much, Forever For Always For Love, and Busybody, those three albums all recorded before they recorded We Are the World.
Good That's God. My point. But Donnie makes a great point of why.
But don't you? Yeah. But Donnie, don't you think? I mean, with the extensive background experience that Luther has, that he can that
yeah
he
from a background singing standpoint,
because kind of
he came up as a background,
even though
right.
he's rising.
Oh, Oh, absolutely.
Oh, he could go in blindfolded with headphones on. He'd be fine.
Because, yeah, he could easily have been one of the people in the chorus and not doing the solos. But you can't put Luther on a song like this and not have him be a soloist. But I don't see where they could have put him in there and taken somebody else out and not have it be too black.
Dan Aykroyd.
I don't even know how he was.
This is a full lead on A Brief History of Black Music by White Artists, Part 1. We will come back and do a Part 2. Our Twitter handle, Total Music Snobs. Follow us on Apple Podcasts. Follow us on Spotify, Google Podcasts, anywhere, everywhere fine RSS feeds are consumed. We'll see you next show. Thank you.